Welcome back to the New Diplomatist Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Garrison Morato, and today I have a very special guest joining me from the International Crisis Group, Mr. Ivan Briscoe. Mr. Briscoe, it's an absolute honor to have you on board the podcast today. Thanks for coming on.
Well, thank you very much for the invitation, and hello to all your listeners.
I know that they'll be fascinated to get into the topic because this is our first ever episode that we've covered subjects in the Latin American sphere, and particularly today we'll be focusing on Venezuela. But before we get too deep into that, sir, would you mind introducing your background, your professional expertise to the listeners who may not be quite as familiar?
Well, yes, of course, with pleasure. I'm originally from Manchester in the north of England, but I have been working on Latin America now since I was a journalist in Argentina in the late 1990s. But in fact, I think my relationship to Latin America can be dated back to even earlier than that. When I was 18, I ended up traveling through Central America when a number of its countries were still at war. Quite an unusual and sometimes harrowing experience that was. And since then, I suppose I've found myself intrigued and increasingly devoted to the region. And I've been working at International Crisis Group as the director for Latin America since 2016.
Wonderful, wonderful. Well, it's a wealth of knowledge, and we're very honored to have you on board the podcast today. And to start discussing the issue at hand, you know, I feel like particularly from the American perspective, and of course I'm speaking very broadly, Venezuela a few years ago kind of stormed onto the news front with the presidential dispute, or the dispute of legitimacy, you might say, between Nicolas Maduro and his challenger, Juan Guaido. Several U.S. senators, particularly Marco Rubio of Florida, who has an interest in the region, you know, made a major point of pushing for freedom or a greater loosening and democratization of Venezuela at that time. There was talks of a coup, there was talks of uprising, and then it sort of felt like it just faded out of Western news for a long period of time now. So I want to try and bring back a discussion of what exactly happened several years ago and where are we at today. So starting with that presidential dispute, for those who are first thinking about this, why does Venezuela have two men claiming to be president?
Well, a very valid question for those who weren't there at the time. Of course, at Crisis Group, we've been covering Venezuela for many years, and we've seen the situation get worse over those years. We've seen what is fundamentally a dispute for political supremacy between a government initially led by Hugo Chavez and since 2013 led by his successor, Nicolas Maduro, pitted against opposition parties representing a range of different interests, but broadly clamoring for democracy against a government that they perceive to be hard left, authoritarian, populist, and a government which is increasingly persecuting them. Now, this tension, this hostility has existed now for over 20 years. In fact, back in the late 1990s, when Chavez came to power, it was already dividing Latin America between those more partial to Chavez, those who opposed him. He was a polarizing figure, a very interesting figure. But this division resonated for years. But what we saw from about 2016, 2017 onwards was increasing hostility between the two sides, between the government of Maduro and the opposition, in a context of tremendous economic decline. The oil industry, on which Venezuela had long relied for its incomes, for its state revenue, was getting gradually less productive, the effect of corruption and mismanagement. The economic policies, heavily statist, interventionist economic policies, were crippling the economy. There wasn't enough food in the shops. The border with Colombia, which was obviously a major trade partner, was being closed on and off, so the supplies weren't getting across the border. For all these reasons, we had this combined political and economic crisis, which really intensified massively in 2017, 2018, to such an extent that Maduro ran for re-election in 2018 in an election which was heavily manipulated in his favor, which the opposition basically boycotted, and which led to a situation in which Maduro claimed another 6 years in office, but was denied recognition by a very large number of countries, among them, of course, very prominently United States. So this was the context at the start of 2019. And the feeling that, you know, the Venezuelan crisis was about to be ratcheted upwards was very high at the time. There was talk of pulling ambassadors out from many countries out of Caracas, of increasing the sanctions which already existed against Maduro and against his government. But what actually happened, we saw, was were the moves by Donald Trump's government at the start of 2019 on multiple fronts, with a tremendous increase of rhetoric and a tremendous application of pressure, maximum pressure, as it was known. We saw sanctions, one of the toughest sanction measures that you could take against Venezuela, which was, of course, effectively denying the sale of Venezuelan state-produced oil to the United States, was taken at the end of January. There were vague threats of military intervention. There was assurances from John Bolton, of course, the National Security Advisor, and others, that the government of Maduro had days left, that the military, senior military figures were about to defect. So there was not just economic pressure, there was a huge amount of political pressure, of the threat, the psychological pressure, of course, was there as well. But when it came to the question of the opposition, we saw a radical change. And that's where Guaido came into his own, because he had been made chair of the National Assembly. Now, the National Assembly was actually in opposition hands. The parliament had been in opposition hands since 2015. And he turned to an article of the Constitution, which in his opinion and the opinion of other senior figures in the opposition, and obviously in the opinion of the United States, gave him the authority to claim the interim presidency, which in principle should last for a short period before fresh elections were called. And it was on this basis that he assumed the mantle on the 23rd of January 2019 of interim president, and thus the battle between two presidents, and of course all the consequences which flow from that, because the United States from that moment recognized Guaido as the president of Venezuela. And although obviously Maduro is in control on the ground in Venezuela, continues to do so. European governments, many European governments followed. Many Latin American governments followed. Colombia shares a 2,000-kilometer border with Venezuela. Extremely intimate historical relations between the countries, still recognizes Guaido as the legitimate president of the country. It has no formal relations with the government of Nicolas Maduro whatsoever. And so this is the origin of the battle between the two presidents, fundamentally motivated by the opposition and its allies' conviction that this derecognition of Maduro and the embrace of an opposition figure would bring the whole structure of Chavismo, the power apparatus created over 20 years, crumbling down. There would be breakaway factions, some military would revolt, people affected by sanctions at the community level would turn against their political leaders, and eventually those free and fair elections would be held and Chavismo would be ejected from power. But that didn't happen. So 3 years later, we are still left with Maduro in power, the remnants of the interim presidency, which keeps on going, even though to all practical effects, it has no meaning on the ground in Venezuela, and a conflict which has become effectively entrenched and which remains extremely difficult to solve.
Well, it's an absolutely fascinating history, and there's so much we could unpack there, but to just dwell a little longer on Mr. Guaido for a second, you know, the question Yes. that's coming in my mind is, I saw on Bloomberg 3 weeks ago that the Venezuelan opposition parties extended the mandate for him as the person they recognize as the nation's legitimate leader, but at the same time, they curbed his powers and criticized, as Bloomberg said, his management of overseas assets and his failure to Yes. make headway in his campaign to oust the government, end quote. Do you feel that despite his continued presence, that he is actually losing that sense of legitimacy in the eyes of the people that it matters most, which is the opposition?
I mean, the interim presidency, in principle, from its start, was a very short-term operation to bring about a change in power, and it hasn't succeeded. Maduro managed to consolidate his rule despite some enormous challenges at the start of 2019. Despite this ongoing economic collapse, despite the pandemic and what it brought, and as a result of that, obviously there is discontent in opposition ranks because they are left with an interim presidency which has no real meaning, which is the nominal holder of a lot of overseas assets belonging to the Venezuelan state, which were taken away from the control of the Venezuelan government because of the policy of de-recognizing Maduro, but which the interim government is not in really in a position to control and use effectively, and there have been accusations of corruption in that regard. But I think also within the opposition, there's a sense that this gambit, having failed, does need reconsidering. There needs to be more of a reconnection between opposition forces and people on the ground in Venezuela. There's a sense that Guaido and other leaders in the opposition have lost all the popularity that they once had. They were once, you know, approved of by 60 or 70% of the Venezuelan population. Now it's down to less than 20%. Wow. They haven't brought the change they promised fundamentally. And the opposition thinks that maybe there is another route. Maybe instead of leading a frontal battle to bring down Maduro, it would be more sensible, more constructive to negotiate certain concessions with him. Maybe it would be a slower process of change, but at least at the end of it, something will be achieved. There will be more political space. Maybe there's an end to political repression. Maybe the economy starts to recover. Maybe some of the 6 million migrants from the country who have spread out in Latin America and the world start to come back. So these sorts of questions are playing out across a very divided opposition, multiple parties, multiple coalitions, multiple different criteria. Many of them, yes, continuing to look to Guaido, but increasingly grudgingly to an extent. But there's one fundamental problem. After everything which has happened since Guaido claimed the interim presidency, it's evident that the government of Maduro would like nothing more in the world to see the end of that interim presidency. It's survived. It's pulled through the last few years. It's been extremely difficult and stressful. But to actually see that rival claimant to the presidency fall and end once and forever would be a huge boost to the morale of the government. And fundamentally, many opposition forces, even though they don't share Guaido's, you know, supposed mandate, don't believe that, you know, he has any sort of real authority anymore, don't want to give the government of Maduro the capacity to make that claim, to feel that self-satisfaction which they would feel. And so it's a difficult position. Ideally, this could be negotiated. This would be the question of the future of the interim government, the future of the interim government's assets, the future of politics and democracy and the judicial system and elections in Venezuela would all be part of a negotiation of the sort which began tentatively again last year. But it, unfortunately, on that occasion, after a few months, they were suspended. There's no immediate sign that they'll begin again. And so we are left where we were before, exactly as you say. The US, for its part, the United States, Washington has continued its support for the interim government with its doubts as well. But again, it doesn't want to give an easy, cheap propaganda victory to Nicolas Maduro, and particularly President Biden, in the rather difficult situation he finds himself in, facing midterm congressional elections at the end of the year, and knowing how difficult it is to win over the Hispanic population of Florida and elsewhere, certainly doesn't want to give an easy victory to, you know, one of the more notorious authoritarian socialists in Latin America. So we find ourselves in a state of inertia, fundamentally, waiting to see what will happen next and who will make the move.
Well, you know, and it is fascinating to see how the domestic political considerations do play in, and notably in 2020's presidential election, Donald Trump's campaign very much made play of the idea that the Democrats were the Americanized version of Maduro to Floridian audiences, and tried to really tie socialists on the left of the Democratic spectrum, like Senator Bernie Sanders and others, to the Maduro idea to really kind of drive home that pain point to Venezuelan American voters and other Hispanics in the region. But you know, getting back to that question of economy, you mentioned earlier that the United States had placed pretty crushing sanctions on the Venezuelan oil apparatus. And yet here we are with not only Maduro still in charge of his country, but recent news reports in the last month saying that they're actually doubling their production and export of oil to overseas, particularly to China, who is purchasing at a 3-year high currently, not only Venezuelan oil, but also Iran, another sanctioned country. So could you unpack a little bit how the regime of Nicolas Maduro was able to overcome such a stringent sanctions regime? And does it signal sort of the death knell of sanctions as sort of the magic bullet when it comes to delegitimizing or weakening the power of authoritarian leaders?
The oil industry has gone through a roller coaster over the last few years. Let's be clear, the oil industry was in sharp decline before those sanctions came in. But the sanctions pretty much immediately removed one of the biggest consumers of Venezuelan oil, and a consumer which paid in dollars, not through other paybacks for loans given earlier, such as oil exports to China. They weren't like the oil exports handed at heavily subsidized rates to partner nations in Central America and the Caribbean. These were dollars. These were paid in dollars. And so it immediately took a huge amount of income out of the exchequer of Caracas. And in fact, some of the estimates you see from government side, sympathizers talk of over 90% of revenues being, you know, removed from the government. I do remember a conversation with a very senior government official, actually, soon after the sanctions were introduced, saying, you know, we have a monthly sum which we spend on our food, our ration, food ration boxes, which are handed out to millions of households in Venezuela every month, the CLAP boxes, and we spend $400 million on that a month. And you know, we don't quite know how we're going to get that money now. We're missing the cash fundamentally. So that was a very serious situation, and obviously the economy took a significant nosedive. But immediately there were means to handle the sanctions, to divert oil, to go through third parties. So they began using one of the old, you know, oil industry allies, which Venezuela had in recent years, which is Rosneft, which was important in enabling exports. There were other forms, other mechanisms whereby the exports could be triangulated. New destinations were, you know, were chosen or were selected to avoid sanctions. And of course, more emphasis was put on other forms of extractive industries, particularly exportation of gold and other rare minerals from the south of the country. I mean, this hasn't, you know, stopped the problems. Obviously, there have been major shortages of fuel in recent years, which have led Venezuela to deal with Iran, so that Iran has sent over tankers of diesel, enabling Venezuela to have the fuel it needs for its public transport and, you know, and other vehicles. And so it has survived. Now we are in a rather interesting different situation, because of course the price of oil has increased sharply in recent times. I think we are close to, if not over, $100 per barrel at the moment, which makes, you know, Venezuelan production, particularly if the geopolitical situation elsewhere worsens, which makes Venezuelan oil more attractive and more interesting. And if Venezuela can find the means to actually, you know, recover its oil exploitation, to recover its refining facilities, and to regain its standing as a legal provider to the world market, China, Russia, Turkey, Iran, and a few others. These are the countries at the moment Maduro has to look for help in boosting the oil industry, in restoring the health of the economy, And they don't necessarily have limitless resources, and they're not going to bet everything they have on Venezuela. In many ways, it would be much better to open up to Western countries and Western corporations. And that's, of course, where the problem is because of the sanctions. But I'll just add one more thing here, Garrison, because this is a very important question on the economy. In 2019, 2020, particularly the first year of the pandemic, obviously, you saw huge drops in GDP in Venezuela. Over the course of 7 or 8 years from 2013, you'd seen the country cumulatively losing something like 80% of its GDP. Wow. You've seen poverty rates hitting over 90%. Obviously, you've seen the millions who've left the country as a result. Absolute misery become rampant in Venezuela. But Maduro has responded over the last few years by effectively, bit by bit, removing all those restrictions and controls over the economy, which were so damaging. Venezuelan economy, largely as a bid to remove hyperinflation, has been dollarized. 60% of transactions in major cities are now taking place in dollars. The controls on imports and exports have largely been removed. Private firms are entering sectors of the economy where they weren't really allowed to before. There's been a boom in shops, new restaurants, new enterprises in Caracas. It's not so visible, obviously, in other parts of the country, which are finding themselves still in a humanitarian emergency. But bits of this money are finding their way through to, you know, the ordinary Venezuelan. So living standards are improving just a little bit. It gives the impression that tremendous effort with the sanctions, to use the sanctions to bring about political change, it did have a moment where there was a moment where it seemed that it would help, you know, generate sufficient pressure on the government, but it didn't quite materialize. And instead, what we have now is this long extended pain, which has been handled by the government now, whereby there are means of survival that maybe are not perfect, not ideal, but which would ensure that at least there is a possibility of economic growth, a modest economic growth in the years that come. And in that context, you do have to wonder, why continue with those sanctions? Well, again, it's rather like, why continue with the interim presidency of Juan Guaido? Once you've assumed a political position and once you've failed to get the results that you want, it becomes incredibly difficult to abandon that initial position, to make that concession. And it's clear that the United States is not going to lift a single sanction until it sees some sign of political change, a fundamental change in the way the government treats political opponents, treats dissidents, treats anyone who is critical of what it does. And at the same time, the government of President Maduro in Caracas says, well, we have done this. We have tried to make the electoral authority more balanced. We have tried to negotiate a return to a democratic competition. We have made these concessions, small concessions. He wouldn't say small, but they are small. But we've seen nothing in return. We've seen nothing from the United States. No sign that they're going to play ball with us. No sign that they're going to move along. So we're not doing anything either. So there's this, again, This stasis in relations. Obviously, it doesn't necessarily harm Biden not to take a risk on Venezuela. Greater harm could come from taking a risk in the Venezuelan policy. And Maduro would probably be thinking at the moment, I could lose a lot if I make a big effort to reach out to the United States or my Latin American rivals and negotiate with the opposition and concede spaces of power and reform the judiciary and hand over to the International Criminal Court senior officials who have been accused of crimes against humanity and the repression of protests. I could do everything which is expected of me, but what do I get? Very little indeed. In fact, I'll probably lose power and my movement will effectively be uprooted, unseated, and the opposition will take power. So these calculations of advantage, obviously, are making it difficult to proceed when we have sanctions. The interim government and the diplomatic position of various states have become relatively stable fixtures in the Venezuelan conflict.
You know, and it is interesting to see this pattern across the world, and obviously the discrepancies between countries are there and they're real, so I don't mean to oversimplify, but it is interesting that the authoritarian structures that entrench, that dig in, that don't yield as much ground, tend to remain for a longer period of time, whether that be the hardliners in Iran, whether that be the Kim family in North Korea, or Nicolas Maduro in Venezuela. I'm sure they're looking at examples like Muammar Gaddafi, who swung from, you know, a very harsh stance towards the United States in the Reagan era to a more moderated stance in the early 2000s to eventually being deposed from power. Or Saddam, who pushed the confrontation too far and was too antagonistic and got himself deposed by force. So it's interesting to see these dictators in all corners of the world sort of adapt to and try and work around the American economic stranglehold and still retain their power at home by little acts and gestures of legitimacy.
You're absolutely right, but I mean, let's not imagine that life was perfect for the Venezuelan political leadership over the last few years.
Oh, absolutely not.
In fact, and I mean, these small concessions, which I just mentioned, you know, trying to make a more balanced electoral authority, going to start negotiations for a short period in Mexico, inviting the prosecutor from the International Criminal Court to visit Venezuela, accepting the opening of a formal investigation or in a declaration on Venezuelan soil by that prosecutor. Maybe they're not hugely substantive changes, but they're significant. They were a response to a very difficult reality in Venezuela. It's not just the economic condition of the Venezuelan people, although that's obviously very important for a movement which came to power, a standard bearer for the poor and the underprivileged in Venezuela. To see poverty like that, it's got to be difficult to digest, you know, morally, if one's cause is effectively to better the lives of these people. But what they have seen in addition to that, obviously, is a corrosion of territorial control in the country. Mm. As a result of all this political conflict, the pressure on the government, the difficulties faced economically and in terms of the challenges around the country by the armed forces, the desertion from the armed forces, meant that the government has had to rely on irregular forces in many cases for, you know, controlling its borders, controlling certain areas. And it's found itself exposed to the backlash from these policies. There have been, you know, very strong, great shows of strength, powerful shows of strength by criminal groups in major Venezuelan cities, above all Caracas. You've seen Colombian rebel forces that have taken root in Venezuela, defying the Venezuelan government, fighting the Venezuelan military. Several dozen Venezuelan military reportedly killed last year in conflicts on the border by former members of the Colombian FARC guerrilla, which had been operating in the area. This sort of, you know, the difficulty of exerting control over territory in conditions of intense political conflict and economic contraction are very visible in Venezuela and represent the challenge to the government. And obviously the government relies on the armed forces, and the armed forces are not happy about this situation. They wish to show that they are in control of a united, territorially sovereign country. And these manifestations of unrest and instability don't play very well internally.
Fascinating details, and we could keep going on this corner of the discussion, but I want to make sure we cover all aspects here. So shifting back to the subject of Colombia, which, as you mentioned, has a substantial and lengthy border and even deeper history between itself and Caracas, let's start with the refugee situation. Obviously, a considerable number of Venezuelans fled the country during this time period of unrest, likely continued to flee it still. Many of those refugees wound up over the border in Colombia. How has the Colombian government coped with this, I don't want to say unwelcome, but perhaps sticky administrative situation of having hundreds of thousands of Venezuelans enter their country under conditions of refugee unrest?
Well, I mean, the Colombian government has been extremely progressive in handling the influx of Venezuelans. We're talking close to 2 million Venezuelans, all of whom now are entitled to claim temporary residency papers, giving them the right to work, giving them the right to basic services. There has been a certain amount of xenophobic backlash against the Venezuelans, particularly in the big cities, and particularly when they've been associated with episodes of violent crime, although it's absolutely disputable whether Venezuelans are actually responsible for any increase in violent crime, or they have just, a number of individuals have just been involved in these unfortunate incidents. But I think more than that, there's the question of whether, you know, the Colombian government's willingness and to accept Venezuelans due to historic ties between the country, due to a sense that they have to help the victims of the Chavista government, that whether these gestures and this, you know, the enabling so many Venezuelans to have papers actually is going to bring about, you know, lasting improvement in their lives. Unfortunately, the Colombian welfare provisions are fairly weak. The job market is very tight at the moment. Obviously, it got much worse during the pandemic. And I can assure you that within Bogota, that the sight of begging Venezuelan families passing through the neighborhoods desperate for food and money has become, over recent years, been a very distressing and extremely regular occurrence. Mm. There is a sense, I think, that partially this is a reflection, of course, of the way that most poor Colombians have to live, you know, from hand to mouth, often in the informal economy, often with no savings at all to turn on. And there's also a sense as well, and I think you'll see this if you listen to Colombian officials on the subject, that the international community has been far less generous in providing relief and support to Venezuelan migrants than it has been to migrants and refugees from other situations, particularly from the Syrian conflict, for example. Mm. Considerably less money has been donated per capita than in those other regions. So I think there's a sense that, yes, Colombia, in the Latin American context, has been, you know, outstandingly forward in providing degree of legal guarantees for Venezuelan migrants and refugees. But the reality on the ground in Colombia is far from straightforward. And do remember what the economic hit which the pandemic brought. During the first 6 or 7 months of the pandemic, when effectively Colombia was in a very extended lockdown, you actually saw tens of thousands of Venezuelans intending, walking to get back into Venezuela. Mm. So difficult were the economic conditions that they found themselves in Colombia. So it's far from straightforward for these people, far from easy to envisage that they will, you know, spend a long time in Colombia and become, over those years, you know, regularly employed people, or whether they will return at some stage to Venezuela. That we don't know at the moment. But there's no doubting that the great difficulties which they have suffered in leaving Venezuela.
One person we haven't really talked much about is Vladimir Putin and the role of the Russian Federation in Venezuela. Obviously, much of the podcast currently in the world is focused on the standoff currently happening diplomatically and in terms of military exercises on the border of Ukraine. The Russians have been speaking and giving various innuendos that they would up or increase their military investments in cooperation with the Maduro government in Venezuela alongside their historical partner in Cuba to sort of counterbalance the United States and sort of bring the pressure to the Western Hemisphere. Kind of a two-part question here, which is, number one, what would you say is the current state of the relationship between Venezuela and Russia, and do you see it trending that way? And secondly, what can the United States do? Because I feel that our strategy, you know, speaking as an American, towards Latin America is so often associated with the Northern Triangle countries and issues of immigration at our border. And you don't hear much about policies towards Venezuela, or like you mentioned, Colombia for refugee relief. So what should the United States do, in your mind, as someone who studied this, to rebalance the situation, not only from a humanitarian standpoint, but strategically as well?
Very hard to answer, because we hear those remarks from, you know, Russian senior officials, you know, vague remarks about obviously increasing military presence in Cuba and Venezuela. This has been something which has been aired at a sort of semi-official level over the years. We know that obviously there is a significant amount of Russian military hardware in Venezuela. There are Russian military technicians and advisors working with the Venezuelan military. Pledges to increase that presence are not totally unreal. They could be carried out in reality, although it does seem from afar that would be, it's more a rhetorical gesture than anything else, for the simple reason that the US still is absolutely militarily dominant in the Latin American region, South America as well. It has in Colombia its principal military ally next door. It has a significant naval presence. It has SOUTHCOM only a few hours away, bases strewn here and there throughout the region. Obviously, it's reticent about using that military power because it knows full well that sometimes military interventions don't have the desired long-term effects, and in fact can poison relations with the United States, as they have done over the decades, or rather in the 20th century. So there would be understandable caution by the United States about responding to any increasing military threat, but there is no doubt the capacity to do so. And one does feel that Russia and Putin, who has famously played a weak hand very strongly in his foreign relations, would, if he moved to boost Russian military presence in the region, be great risk of overplaying his weak hand and facing a reprisal of some sort. That said, no one ignores what happened in 1962, of course, which was the Cuban Missile Crisis, and the sense that using one of these pro-Russian allies in the region would represent a greater threat to the United States than any other move that Russia could do, because of obviously the proximity to US soil. I mean, that is clearly a live memory in the US policymakers' minds, and Putin has got to be aware of it. At the same time, I think that it's just a little bit far-fetched at the moment to imagine that's going to take place. And also, just to qualify the Russian-Venezuelan relationship for a second here, I think is important. This is not a relationship based on unconditional friendship. Mm. Yes, there are long-standing ties between Rosneft and the Venezuelan oil industry. Yes, Putin and Maduro have seen each other relatively frequently. Yes, when the US was mounting its international campaign to unseat Maduro and the issue of Venezuela was taken to the UN Security Council, it was Russia which mounted the most strident, outspoken defense of Venezuela and denounced the US for you know, unfair intervention in another nation state's affairs. So, yes, we know about all that. But at the same time, Russia has, to a large extent, cut off the supply of easy credit to Venezuela. It's not been the most eager investor in recent years, and it maybe would not want to place all its faith in a continuation of the Maduro government in an extremely hostile climate, with Venezuela depending on its Russian ally for survival in an open conflict with the United States. I think that possibly would not be exactly what the Russians would like, because to a degree they don't trust the Maduro government either. They feel to a large extent that Maduro has mismanaged the economy as well. That is the fundamental cause of many of the problems seen in Venezuela today. So it's always possible in a highly mobile, dynamic international crisis that we will see, obviously, new theatres emerging if, unfortunately, the hostilities do escalate. But I would be cautious about placing Venezuela right in the heart of an emerging U.S.-Russian conflict at the moment.
Indeed, indeed. And for the final question of the day, sir, sort of a personal question, as someone who's spent a long time in the region, if there was one aspect of U.S. policy that you could change tomorrow for the better in the area that you feel like is being neglected or slowly rolled out or not noticed or misapplied, what would be the top line thing that you would shift for the betterment of, you know, the Venezuelan people, of the people of Colombia, you know, democracy in the region, peace in the region, as in your role in the International Crisis Group? What would that kind of look like if you could pick one thing? And we'll end there.
Well, it's would I pick something from history? Would I pick something related to one country in particular?
Assuming it could only be done in the contemporary era, right now.
I don't think I would. Oh, that's such a difficult question to answer, because the words which come up to my head would be, and obviously drug policy, obviously migration, the sanctions which we have just spoken about. Fundamentally, what you would like to see in the United States policy towards the region is a greater degree of real respect for the decisions taken by other countries and an ability to withstand the political changes in other countries, not to pick one's favorite, you know, partners or, you know, nations with their governments which are most akin to, you know, US policy goals, but to, you know, respect the democratic aspirations of every single country and who they've voted. But that's an extremely general thing to say. I think in the immediate short term, I would suggest that major questioning of drug policy in the region, particularly in Colombia, particularly in Mexico. In a sense, the ongoing war on drugs has generated much greater harm in the countries where supply and trafficking is targeted. It has been, as it were, displaced harm away from the United States. And obviously, with respect, you know, we understand that there are victims of overdoses and addiction in the United States. But that doesn't justify the way that, unfortunately, coca-growing peasants have been treated over the recent decades in Colombia. So that would be one thing. And I suppose the other would be just to seek a more proactive role in resolving or managing the great political disputes that emerge in Latin America, and try not to deal with them in terms of the priorities of US internal politics, but rather concentrate on what the Latin American nations need for their future peace and stability. And I mean, that's sounding extremely amorphous and almost impossible to realize, but I think if you burrow down into individual countries, if you burrow down into what's happening in Chile or what happened in Bolivia or what should be happening in Central America now, you have, you know, in different countries the chance to support new democratic options which perhaps deal with some of the accumulated, you know, hardships and historical injustices of the past. And the US should support them and shouldn't take sides on the basis of broader global strategic goals.
Sound advice, and it's an honor to have hosted you, sir, Ivan Briscoe, on the podcast today regarding Venezuela. I threw the gamut at you. We've gone from presidential disputes to Russia to economics, and you handled it all with deftness. And thank you very much for bringing your depth of knowledge to our listeners. I know they'll appreciate this, our first ever Latin American episode where we focused on subjects in the region, but I do hope to have you on again sometime.
Well, Garrison, that's been a pleasure to be with you. I hope that the listeners have enjoyed it, and I look forward to that.